This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
Society has decided, I think, for fairly obvious reasons, to focus on these other crimes, right? We have chosen, we've made a choice, a political choice, a cultural choice, to focus on certain crimes and not others, right? Even what we define legally as crime is a political choice. But then there's another choice made among those things that we've labeled crime, which are the ones that we're going to devote law enforcement resources toward? Which are the ones that we're going to prosecute, and what are we going to ignore?
In his astute and timeless book, How to Lie with Statistics, Daryl Huff writes, "The secret language of statistics, so appealing in a fact-minded culture, is employed to sensationalize, inflate, confuse, and oversimplify." This statement is at least as true as it was in 1954 when it was first published. Among the subjects most prone to statistical abuse, criminal justice. Our guest today on Sea Change Radio is Peter Calloway, an outspoken public defender whose Twitter thread about crime in San Francisco went a little bit viral last week. In the first half of our two-part conversation, we discuss the significance of U.S. Supreme Court Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson, who's not only the first black woman to serve on the highest court, but also the first public defender. We also talk about the role of the public defender's office and why people tend to fall for sensationalized crime statistics. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Peter Calloway. Peter is a public defender in San Francisco. Peter, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Alex, thank you so much. I'm happy to be here. I guess I should note that I am speaking to you today, you know, in my personal capacity, not as a representative of my office. But again, thanks for inviting me on.
First, why don't you explain to our listeners what a public defender does and what motivates attorneys to become public defenders?
So, you know, a public defender is a lawyer who is appointed by the court to represent somebody who's been accused of a crime that could conceivably result in them being jailed and who cannot afford to hire their own attorney. They've existed, you know, essentially since the middle of the last century. I won't go into the origins necessarily, but the main point is, you know, there are attorneys. There are defense attorneys, and among the defense attorneys, there are public defenders. And a lot of people who choose to become public defenders are doing it, you know, because they feel sort of a connection to the sort of disenfranchised, right? People who have been in various ways, you know, harmed by our society, cast aside. And, you know, sometimes see it as something of a calling. And that's true for me. That's sort of what drew me to this work. And in the last, I'd say maybe 10 years or so, as the country has sort of began to sort of awaken to what has become known as sort of mass incarceration or the human caging crisis, I think a lot more people have been drawn to public defense as a sort of part of a new civil rights movement.
It's very much in line with the ideals of this country in that everybody has a right to an attorney and a trial, and you're innocent before proven guilty. That was not always the case and it's still not the case in many, many countries.
Correct. The sort of lofty principles that, you know, are inscribed in the marble edifices in which this sort of system is conducted, say things like equal justice under law. The reality on the ground, of course, is anything but that, right? So if you ask 10 public defenders their reasons for being a public defender, you'll get some of the same reasons, but you'll have some different ones too, right? And some people are really motivated by those principles of justice and equality and fairness. And the fact that there are, you know, constitutional principles that are sort of being defended when we're in court, right? The right to a fair trial and the right to an attorney. Some people are motivated by, again, like sort of a civil rights rationale, you know? The fact that if you're a person of color, particularly a black person in this country, you know, you're more likely to be harmed by this system at every single step, right? More likely to be accused of crime, more likely to be stopped by the police, more likely to be searched, even though you're less likely to be found with contraband than a white person would be. You're more likely to be sentenced more harshly after being more likely to be convicted. It's really disgraceful. And these statistics are true in San Francisco as well. I think there's a fairly recent report that says, I believe the new statistic is someone who's black is 10 times more likely to be stopped by the police. You know, despite being 3 to 5% of the population, the jail is more than 50% black. It's pretty, you know, pretty shocking stuff. And again, that extends across the country, right? And it's not just about race, right? It's also about poverty, mental illness. We cage in this country around 2.2 million people on any given day. 500,000 or so of those are people who are caged prior to being convicted of any crime, usually because they can't afford to pay some money bail to secure their release. There's another 4.5 million or so on probation or parole, right? So where the state continues to exercise some constraint on their freedom that can often be pretty extreme in the sense that a probation officer, a parole officer can show up unannounced and search your home, force you to take a drug test. And if they don't like what they see, even if it's what's called a technical violation and you haven't been accused of committing some new crime, they can take you back to jail or prison. Jail or prison is so harmful that the effects on life expectancy of people who are incarcerated are so extreme that they've actually reduced the overall life expectancy of the United States. So again, really shocking stuff. This is what motivates a lot of people to become public defenders.
And watching the confirmation of Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson was a reminder how people like yourself, if you decide to go into politics, it's a lot of these cases are going to be used against you. My mother was a civil rights attorney, and as a young boy, I remember asking her, like, when I heard about her cases, I'd be like, how can you be defending this murderer or these terrible people? And she was quite proud and had deep convictions that these people deserve the best the law could provide, that they deserved a fair trial with a competent attorney, and that was her obligation. And yet, when you watch these confirmation hearings, like, that pride seems to have been eviscerated by the scaremongering tactics, the tough on crime police, if you will, that this person defended this person. So A plus B equals C. What is so pernicious about our system that this is allowed to fester and become almost an accepted truth? Why don't people push back and express more anger and pride about the important role of public defenders and other lawyers who are providing an important service?
It's an important question. And you know, I think that's one of the reasons why this confirmation is significant, right? It's an opportunity to have that conversation in public with a whole lot of people watching. But that also makes it very important to get right, you know, so the people who have a platform ought to be taking a strong stand and ought to have a well-reasoned justification for that question. How can you represent those people, mm-hmm. right? I mean, people who are accused of crime in this country are now and sort of have always been sort of ripe for sort of scorn and disdain, right? It's easy to say we should do what we can to make sure that people who didn't who didn't actually commit the crime don't go to prison for it, right?
Right.
Much harder to say for many people that we need to make sure that even somebody who did commit harm gets a vigorous defense where their rights are well protected and upheld, that the state is put to its burden and not simply rubber stamped by a judge or a jury, you know. And part of the reason for that is also to endorse this system in the way that we often do, that our politicians often do, really sets aside key questions that very few people are asking among policymakers, and that you've seen sort of emerge in recent months and years as a sort of response to the many, many shootings of mostly unarmed and mostly people of color by police, right? So I'm talking about the defund movement, the abolition movement, and the like.
What are the example questions that you're thinking of?
Well, the reason I mention it is because we know that this is not the way to reduce harm, right? We know that because the literature shows that prison is criminogenic, right? Mm-hmm. It makes it more likely that somebody's going to commit a crime. We know that punishment is not the way to prevent somebody from committing a future harm, right? But meaningful accountability is the way to do that.
And do we also know that harsher penalties for crimes don't necessarily dissuade criminals from committing those crimes?
We do, yeah. And again, the literature is clear on that as well. And the reasons are somewhat obvious, right? I mean, people who are in the position where they are committing crimes are not sitting back and thinking about possible consequences and sort of gaming out the risk of getting caught versus the possible benefit of whatever is happening. We're talking about mostly crimes of poverty and mental illness. Even if you look at really extreme harms, right? Things that everybody in a society agrees we don't want to endorse, right? Dig a little deeper into the life of the person who's committed that harm. Look at, I'm confident that if you select any person, for example, who's on death row anywhere in the country and investigate their life story, they've been themselves victims of extreme trauma and may often do suffer from diagnosed or diagnosable forms of mental illness, right? And again, that's not to endorse the thing that the person does. It's to say that maybe we should be creating systems of care, you know, and of accountability that have been demonstrated to actually reduce the likelihood of future harm rather than just caging human beings and warehousing them in our prisons.
I don't mind being in jail, but I gotta stay there so long. I don't mind being in jail, but I gotta stay there so long. Every friend I've had done shook hands and gone.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to Peter Calloway. He's a public defender in San Francisco. So, Peter, you had a thread on Twitter that I found hit the mark in a lot of ways. If you can kind of give us a brief overview of the Chesaboudin recall and the political realities right now in San Francisco and how that relates to this thread about crime, that would be terrific.
Sure. Well, I'll start with the recall of Chesaboudin. So, right, he's elected in 2019, took office in 2020. He was a former public defender.
He's elected to district attorney, right?
I'm sorry, yes. He's elected a district attorney, so he's the chief prosecutor for the city and county of San Francisco. He had previously worked as a public defender. He was sort of a pioneer of the effort in California to end the use of money bail, where a person is held prior to trial in jail for no reason other than the fact that they are poor and can't afford to pay some money. So so he's elected to DA on a very progressive platform, right? Promising to end the use of money bail and reduce pretrial incarceration, promising to do things to minimize the impact that incarceration has on children. For example, using a diversion program for parents where instead of going to jail, parents can do some robust programming designed to get at the root causes of why they might have committed some harm, and then ultimately the case is resolved that way. Efforts at reducing the racial bias in our system, for example, eliminating or not prosecuting cases where police racially profile somebody, and that's the only reason for the contact, not prosecuting juveniles as adults, and on, along with a number of sort of affirmative sort of uses of the tools of the office in ways that hadn't really been done before. So going after the manufacturers of these ghost guns, for example, that are untraceable and can be purchased by anybody on the internet, going after employers for things like wage theft. We don't talk about it much, but wage theft in dollar amount dwarfs the total amount of all of what the police call property crime combined, right? All burglaries and robberies and thefts from Walgreens and things of that sort. But society has decided, I think, for fairly obvious reasons, to focus on these other crimes, right? We have chosen, we've made a choice, a political choice, a cultural choice, to focus on certain crimes and not others, right? Even what we define legally as crime is a political choice. But then there's another choice made among those things that we've labeled crime, which are the ones that we're going to devote law enforcement resources toward? Which are the ones that we're going to prosecute? And what are we going to ignore?
And speaking of these biases, we've had decades and decades or centuries of looking the other way at what is now called white-collar crime or antitrust legislation, wage theft, things from a top-down crime system where we have created our own sets of biases that people who are at the lower end of the socioeconomic system, those are the criminals. They're easy marks for our subconscious. And so things like you mentioned the theft in Walgreens, there was like a thing that went viral of some guy just went through a Walgreens on a bike and got picked up on the camera where he just basically was just shoplifting willy-nilly and rode out. And this was used as an example of, see, San Francisco is a crime-infested hellhole. And it was used by the Trump administration and other right-wingers as this is what liberal policies mean, is that no one is safe and it's chaos and anarchy.
Yeah. I have a friend, his name is Alec Karakatsanis. He wrote a book called Usual Cruelty. And he goes through a number of examples in that book. One of the ones I like a lot is he talks about that it's illegal in most places for people to play craps on the sidewalk, right? To gamble with dice. But it's not illegal for hedge funds to gamble on the price of wheat, right? Or financial institutions to gamble with people's mortgages, you know, causing literally financial systems to collapse with essentially no consequence. I think it's true that there wasn't even a single criminal prosecution to emerge from that, the 08-09 financial crisis. So yes, we focus on specific things, and some of that makes some sense. You can understand a sort of visceral reaction to something like that Walgreens video. It suggests that there's this sort of free-for-all in San Francisco. I get that. Part of what I was trying to do by writing about this, and part of why I'm grateful to have been invited onto your show, is to talk about this idea that the media chooses what it's going to put on the front page, right? The media chooses what videos it's going to circulate and show. And by and large, they make choices that perpetuate these sorts of biases that we're talking about. And there's sort of a feedback loop there, right? If politicians are hearing from their constituents among the foremost concerns are things like petty theft by mostly people who are deeply poor and stealing to survive. Whether those concerns are driven by media biases or not, the politicians are perhaps going to be responsive to that, right? And if the media instead gave a better picture of the harms that are produced by our society, right? I think it's tens of thousands of deaths a year, at least, that are caused by air pollution, for example, then politicians would at least be more likely to have different priorities, right? And we could perhaps begin to address the fact that, according to this new IPCC report, I think we've got about 3 years until it's basically all over. And just circling back to the petty theft point, right? I'm a public defender. I've never seen any evidence in any one of my cases of a theft that is part of an organized retail theft operation, right? Instead, I see people who are taking shoes and then putting those shoes on their feet because they didn't have shoes.
Yeah, these are not premeditated crimes generally. And it's not Ocean's 11 premeditation, where they have maps and wingmen and how Hollywood likes to glamorize jewelry theft, let's say.
Exactly. But yeah, that is not what we've got here. We've got something radically different. And so I wrote about this issue generally. And the trigger was an article I read in the Washington Post in which the author...
Scott Wilson, was it?
That's his name, yes. He wrote about the tenderloin, right? And
for our listeners around the country, why don't you explain what the tenderloin is?
Sorry, yeah. The tenderloin is a neighborhood in San Francisco. I think it's, what, 10 by 12 blocks maybe?
Yeah, it's right next to Union Square.
Right. And as I concede in the thread, right, it's the epicenter of the city's homelessness and drug crises. It's a place I am almost every single day. It's a place I walk through to get to work. It's a place where, up until somewhat recently, you know, open air drug use had been essentially tolerated by police, which of course drove open air drug use from other areas in the city into the Tenderloin. You know, it's got a long and storied history. There seems to be this perception that things have gotten so much worse in the last couple of years, and the people who are trying to recall Chesa Boudin, the district attorney, are pointing to this neighborhood and saying, look what he did, right?
There I was completely wasting, out of work and down. All inside, it's so frustrating as I drink from town to town. Feel as though nobody cares if I let one die. So I might as well begin to put some action in my life. Breaking the law.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to San Francisco public defender Peter Calloway. Anybody who's been to the Tenderloin in the last 30 years can vouch for the fact that this has been a long time suffering neighborhood of the city. There's just a lot of poverty there historically.
Right. And it's also, though, a place of great beauty and joy, right? I think people reacted to this thread, and I know we'll get more into that in a moment. Some of them really, really viciously, including doing things like trying to find my home address and post it online. Thankfully, they've failed, but really, really vicious sort of attacks. But then a lot of like more or less good faith critiques, like, are you really trying to deny that there are things that need fixing in the Tenderloin? And I don't think that my article, or my thread rather, could be read in good faith to conclude that I'm denying that there are issues. There are clearly issues. But again, I think if people would spend time in this neighborhood, and I suspect that the people who are reacting this way, you know, who are sort of condemning me for suggesting that actually, according to the data, crime is not out of control in the Tenderloin. It's actually lower than it was before the pandemic.
Yes, let's run through that data real quickly if you can.
Sure. You know, the article I was responding to said that crime in the Tenderloin has jumped by double-digit percentages.
Jumped in percentages in from 2021 to 2022 or 2020 to 2000. It's all during this pandemic, which is definitionally an outlier period.
Yeah, so there's that issue too, right? But even on its own terms, right? Even setting aside the sort of baseline, it was, you know, deeply misleading in that it's correct that these crimes as measured by SFPD increased by double-digit percentages. But that sort of jumped out to me. So I went and looked at the data, which is publicly available on the SFPD's crime dashboard. And I learned that the double-digit percentage increases were 10% and 27%. But the actual number increases were 1 and 6, right? So homicides had increased from 10 to 11, and rape had increased from 22 to 28.
It's such a small sample size that it's really hard to use percentages in this as a indicator of a trend.
Yeah, well, I think that when you say that something jumped by double-digit percentages, that person is probably not going to assume that it jumped by one incident.
Right.
And so that seems like a very deliberate choice to portray it as a double-digit percentage increase in an article where, or in a paragraph where you're sort of allowing the mayor to justify her decision to deploy more police to this neighborhood to essentially commit more harm against poor people and people of color. So I then proceeded to run the numbers on crime in the city overall, and I used 2019. I learned that citywide from 2019 to 2021, homicides did increase by 36%, but the actual number increase was 15, right? Now, that is not to suggest that 15 additional homicides doesn't matter. It's not to suggest that the impact of those events on the people who are involved, right? The family members of the victims, the communities, you know, the ripple effects can be severe. My dad's father was murdered when he was 15 years old. They never found the person who did it, and it changed the course of my dad's life, right? People think that if you have conversations like this, that you somehow don't care about the harms produced by crime.
Be sure to tune in next week to See Change Radio for the second half of my discussion with San Francisco public defender Peter Calloway.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to See Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Eddie Harris, Ella Fitzgerald, and Judas Priest. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to See Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For See Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.